The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay. It's very nice of you all to come. You know, I feel a little bad because I was like packed a lot of information into this talk, which I always hate in talks, and I didn't write any jokes, which I always also hate. You know, because it's so pleasant when there's jokes, and I'm also a little worried because I think Curry's over here, and if he's funny, and everybody's gonna be sitting here going, you know. It must be nice, you know, over there. But anyway, and the other thing I should apologize for, you know, just in the spirit of apologizing at the beginning of the talk, is that, the description was that I was going to talk about the article that was written in 1969, or basically talk about the rest of Israeli history through that lens. And what I'm sort of doing is I use that as my launching pad into a whole couple of years of research, and in a very condensed way, this is what I've come up with. So it's, you know, take that as you will. But so the class character of Israel was an article written by two brilliant Israeli anti-Zionist socialists, Moshe Machover and Akiva Or, from the Israeli Socialist Organization, or as it's known by its periodicals or publications name, Matzpen. And its primary contribution was in breaking the myth that the Israeli working class was like all other working classes, and that mutual activity of Israelis and Palestinians, independent of... Thank you.
I know, I told you to keep talking, and it's really hard to do that when I'm pointing something in your face, but...
Thank you. Okay. So mutual activity of Israelis and Palestinians, independent of the activity of the Arab masses in the region, was possible. It was actually a significant break from the international left's position on Israel up to this point. And what they argued was that despite the fact that Israel is a class society and as such has class conflict, there is an overarching conflict of Zionism with the indigenous population. They argued that the external conflict isn't a derivative of the class conflict. On the contrary, it blunts it because of the unique role Israeli workers play in a colonial state that upholds Western imperialist interests, specifically, U.S. interests. But since 1969, a lot has changed for Israeli workers, and some of the original arguments are a little dated. And, you know, for example, while at the time the Israeli working class enjoyed direct foreign subsidization in the form of governmental social spending, today the bulk of foreign capital is military aid. American aid steadily, you know, $3 billion annually for the last couple of decades, and today it's also proportionately less of an influence on Israeli economy as it was well into the early 90s. So their main argument, a working class that's resting on social subsidies from foreign imperialist aid, is no longer strong enough on in and of itself. You know, and another, just like an aside, that they have like this whole argument about immigrants and the immigrant character of the Israeli society. At the time, 75% were foreign-born. Today, it's like the inverse. There's 24% of Israelis are foreign-born, and yet they pull further to the right. But they wrote, the experience of 50 years does not contain a single example of Israeli workers being mobilized on material or trade union issues to challenge the Israeli regime itself. It is impossible to mobilize even a minority of the proletariat in this way. On the contrary, Israeli workers nearly always put their national loyalties before their class loyalties. Although this may change in the future, this does not remove the need for us to analyze why it has been so for the last 50 years. And since that article was written, almost another 50 years have passed, and still there's no real legacy of revolutionary activity in the Israeli working class. And so I'm going to argue the following. You want kind of a structure. First, by examining the formative years of the Jewish working class in Palestine, we can see that it's the nature of a settler working class and its unique relationship to the state that distinguishes the Israeli proletariat from other working classes. Second, that the 1967 occupation served to deepen the connection between the working class and the colonial character of the state. And finally, that the Palestinian national liberation struggle negates the privileges of, and therefore is opposed by, the Israeli working class. So, we start. Basically, there are different kinds of colonial settlements and occupations. Machover's argument then and now is that Israel is a unique colony, but I tend to disagree. To me, the Zionist project is a perfect example of the pure settlement. And based on Australian historian Dr. Patrick Wolfe's research, the economy of a pure settlement is based on European labor, which, quote, together with the forcible removal or the destruction of the native population, allied the settlers to regain the sense of cultural or ethnic homogeneity identified with a European concept of nationality. At its core, the pure settler society is based on what Wolfe termed a logic of elimination. He argues that a settler movement aims to build something new, which implies replacing or eliminating the existing society. Elimination can be achieved through expulsion, death, or assimilation. And where elimination isn't possible, separation is the next viable option to settlers. In either case, the result is the same: one society taking over another's territory. In contrast to the immigrant who joins the society, settlers bring their own sovereignty, challenging and, if successful, displacing the indigenous society. What's important is that this can't be done without the commitment of a laboring class, because land settlement requires labor and large numbers of people. The commitment of a laboring class to colonization can only be expected when it's offered a stake in the settlement, an incentive to sacrifice and to struggle against the indigenous population. In the example of the United States, in order to encourage settlement, the government offered cheap or free frontier property to European immigrants crossing westward. But once settlement was complete and elimination was successful, cheap land was no longer available. The settler option had allowed a section of the American working class a form of relief, up until the early 1920s, whereby one could retire after a few years of labor and purchase land. Indigenous rights were at that time an obstacle, were an obstacle to the American workers' social ascension. However, those realities, which pitted the interests of white settlers against other oppressed groups, no longer really exist. So a settler state, I think, ceases to be such a state either when there are no longer lands to be settled and the process of elimination is successful, or when the elimination is unsuccessful and the indigenous population's national movement is triumphant in ending the occupation, inshallah. So examples of the former, Australia, the US, and an example of the latter is Algeria. South Africa, as a pure colony, failed, but a socio-economic apartheid still exists. Most black people are still dispossessed. Only 7.5% of South African land was redistributed. And I actually recommend, there's this book by Andy Clarino that I've been reading, that neoliberal apartheid, for more of a comparison in Israel and South Africa post-1994. I have a whole bunch of books at the end. I'm going to be referencing a bunch of stuff. If you want to come up and ask about any particular section of the talk, like where that comes from, feel free. So in Palestine, it was impossible to eliminate the indigenous population. It was necessary to settle for separation. The logic of elimination and the Zionist goal of sovereignty led the Zionists to accept a sort of territorial compromise. The Zionists preferred to take less than all of historic Palestine, where they could maintain a Jewish demographic majority and an economy protected from Arab labor and Arab produce. The process of colonization is still unfolding. The state is expanding settlements into the Al-Naqab Desert, where it continues to displace Bedouin villages, of course, into the West Bank, and it maintains the potential to settle other nearby territories, like Gaza. There also continues to be a large diaspora of Palestinians, roughly 10 million people, some of whom wish to return, and almost all of whom are owed reparations for their expulsion and dispossession. And so long as these realities persist, Israel is a colonial settler state. In the pre-state period, the Zionist movement was led largely by wealthy Zionists of the World Zionist Organization, WZO, who initially regarded the laborer and socialist Zionists with reluctance or enmity because, under the influence of Marxist ideas in Eastern Europe, the pioneers sought to erect a socialist Jewish state. But by the 1930s, the Jewish working class in Palestine was seen as the only agent which could realize the Zionist project. Bringing us back to our earlier point, which that there's no way to commit people to hard labor and difficult conditions without funding the settler labor movement. Israeli sociologist Michael Shalev characterized this as a, quote, practical alliance between a settlement movement without settlers and a workers' movement without work. So through the donations of the WZO, it was possible to create relatively high employment for Jewish workers in Palestine and an economic sector which was, despite the WZO's funding, largely controlled by labor Zionists. Zachary Lachman explains in Comrades and Enemies that rather than constituting one of the many socio-political forces within a diverse movement, labor was at the helm of Zionist development. In fact, labor played the role that a capitalist class couldn't, because the capitalists can't subordinate profit making to forward a national project. So labor stepped in and created its own enterprises that it subsidized with foreign donations it was receiving. But despite the land without a people mythology of the time, the region was abundant with cheaper and more experienced labor, Arab labor, rendering Jewish workers undesirable. Attaining wages for Jews approaching European standards in these conditions was impossible, making it unlikely they would stay in Palestine. In fact, the Zionist project was at risk of failing during the period of the second Aliyah, or Jewish immigration wave, 1904 to 1914, because of constant immigration of Jewish settlers in search of livelihood and stability, either back to Europe or onto the United States. So the conquest of labor, originally an expression of the transformation of a petty bourgeois settler into a laborer, now expressed the concerted campaign to replace Arab workers in Palestine's economy. And this effort was critical. The three strategies were employed towards this end. First, the creation of the collective agricultural settlement vis-a-vis the Moshav or the kibbutz. Second, a targeted campaign to exclude Arab labor from a discrete Jewish economy. And finally, the sustained efforts to persuade non-Jewish employers and the British administration to hire Jewish workers despite being more expensive and more organized than Arab workers. Unfortunately, I can't really go into depth into all of these. I will go into a little bit, but hopefully I'm trying to work on a forthcoming article. So, to be continued. But so Gershon Shafir, in his book, which I have here too, Land, Labor, and the Origins of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, describes the development of cooperative agricultural settlements in the early 1900s. It was thought that a group of workers banded together could be both capitalist and labor. As it turned out, profit was impossible. But nonetheless, Shafir argues that it was the material conditions Zionists faced in Palestine that shifted the yeshuv to favor the collectivist approach of settlement and not preconceived socialist ideals. In other words, their inability to live as cheaply as Arabs led them to seek cheaper ways of existence. These are the not-so-socialist origins of the Zionist kibbutz. The fate of Zionism came to be seen as dependent on the success of the campaign for exclusive Jewish employment. Even the most idealistic Zionist pioneers had to see the exclusion of Arab labor as intricately bound with a national cause. To this end, the General Organization of Workers in the Land of Israel, the Histadrut, was founded in 1920, not a trade union, but rather an organization fighting for exclusive Jewish labor. The Histadrut set up a number of enterprises, including a bank, a construction contracting company, social services such as healthcare and housing, making it kind of a weird morphed organization of worker representation meets employer meets state institution. In the 1920s, as the campaign for the conquest of labor began to take hold, the contradictory position of Zionist nationalism and colonization with the socialist principle of internationalism raised difficult questions for labor Zionists. Initially, a significant minority in the Zionist left believed that Jews needed to organize Arab workers in order to raise wages and reduce the differences between them. But insofar as this notion gained traction among Jewish workers and union activists, it was only in mixed workplaces where Arab-Jewish solidarity and joint organization served to improve the lot of Jewish workers and sustain their presence. Historical examples in the article. Ultimately, the idea that Jewish-Arab solidarity could raise wages for the region's millions of Arabs enough to open up a significant number of unskilled jobs for Jews was impractical and was understood to be incompatible with Zionist aspirations, that is, the establishment of a homogeneous Jewish society. For adherents of the right wing of the Zionist labor movement, this wasn't a difficult conclusion, but the quasi-Marxist left wing found it a bitter pill to swallow. The struggle to exclude workers based on their ethnicity seemed profoundly unsocialist. Interesting. As unemployment grew, however, most principled or moral opposition subsided. 1936. In April 1936, a general strike spread through the Palestinian peasant and working classes, demanding the barring of land sales to Jews, an end to Jewish immigration, and the British Mandate. This is in response to the conquest of labor. This quickly developed into widespread political revolt, with the most militant peasants taking up arms. Despite having 10 times as many troops as Palestinian militants, it took 3 years for the British, aided by the Zionists, to quell the revolt. Leveraging increased Arab unemployment during the rebellion, the Histadrut's Arab Department, the Palestinian Labor League, PLL, inserted itself everywhere possible. It worked to turn desperate Arab workers into strikebreakers. Lachman writes, it came to, quote, function as an employment agency during the revolt years, supplying Arab workers deemed reliable from a security and political standpoint to the Histadrut's contracting office for various public works. And the Jewish agency paid Arab port workers and contractors to keep Haifa harbor open, with the threat of kibbutz members as strikebreakers compelling the workers to accept the terms. The use of kibbutz members as scabs during the Arab revolt became a widespread Zionist tactic to undermine the revolt and secure a foothold for Jewish labor. The PLL also played an important intelligence role during the revolt, using information that they received from Arab contacts about conditions in various Arab towns and villages and the doings of specific individuals and organizations. And they also passed out Zionist propaganda in Arabic language just to undermine Arab nationalism. And in the end, they closed the PLL department after the revolt and didn't admit Arabs into the Histadrut ranks until the 1960s. Which leads us to statehood. So the foundation of the Israeli state was completed through the near total destruction of Palestinian existence. The nature of settler colonialism, as I said, is complete replacement of a pre-existing society. Significantly, the major perpetrators of the ethnic cleansing came from the left wing of the labor movement. Mapam party members and Mapam kibbutz members. Mapam was formed in 1948 under the auspices of the Marxist Zionist left-wing challenge to Ben-Gurion's dominant Mapai party. Joel Beinon, in Was the Red Flag Flying There, writes, quote, since most of the officers of the Palmach Haganah and subsequently the IDF were Mapam members, Mapam assumed both political and operational responsibility for conducting Israel's war of independence. Mapam kibbutzim and other Jewish settlements drove Palestinians off their lands, then distributed the lands amongst themselves and harvested their crops. With cover provided by Soviet Union arguments that Arab militaries and their British backers were reactionary, they argued that establishing a Jewish state was anti-British imperialism. The appropriation of Palestinian property, argues Beinon, was a form of primitive accumulation that allowed the Jewish economy to develop, particularly its agriculture. Vacated Palestinian real estate was distributed to Israel's Jewish population as it more than doubled in its first 4 years. By 1954, over 30% of Israel's Jewish population lived in Arab property. Over 1.1 acres of cultivatable lands were confiscated from absent, present, and present absentee Arabs, which increased Jewish farming land by 250%. The UN Refugee Office estimated that the value of stolen Arab wealth at what today would be over $5 billion. So, Ben-Gurion and Mapai used the expropriated Arab property, and they created a segregated labor market, employing Jews exclusively with few exceptions before 1967. And even today, Jews and Arabs don't often work alongside each other. The labor market continues to be very stratified. Expropriation and segregation coupled with foreign capital investment offered rising living standards to the working class in exchange for which Mapai demanded strict discipline justified by the constant conflict with Arabs. Mapai was able to satisfy the material needs of workers and subsidize business interests because of billions of dollars in foreign investment in the state in the form of unilateral transfers, donations from World Jewry, reparations from West Germany, and U.S. government grants. A full 40% of Israeli workers were employed by the Histadrut or the state, meaning that the Histadrut, the state, and the burgeoning bourgeoisie shared an interest of restraining working class militancy. In fact, the strength of the ruling labor bureaucracy was derived from its ability to do so. They established a tripartisan agreement between state, bourgeoisie, and labor. And as I said, the particular nature of a settler working class puts it in the unique position of partner to the state, guaranteeing it some protections while at the same time subordinating its class interests to that of the state. Israeli workers had been given, or taken, much of the booty from the 1948 genocide. It was enjoying housing, education, and healthcare benefits from the Histadrut, and the state afforded it. Something was wrong about that, right? Benefits the Histadrut and the state afforded it. And until 1973, it was enjoying a rising living standard comparable not to the Arab states of the region, but to Europe. So it consistently cooperated with the state and its employers. Unlike Israeli workers, the American working class has a long history of anti-racist activity, partly because white and black workers routinely work side by side, and more importantly, racism for the class as a whole has proven detrimental. One famous study showed that white southern workers, where racism is more rampant, made less than black workers in the north, where unionization rates were higher, right? Though, of course, there were in the South also notable instances of cross-racial solidarity, like the Brotherhood of Timber Workers, the Populist Movement, and during the New Orleans General Strike of 1892, just some examples. The United Mining Workers of America was famously multiracial when the AFL was still segregated, and that was because of how dangerous the labor was and how much trust was necessary between the skilled and unskilled workers. The CIO, under the not radical leadership of John Lewis, opened its doors to black workers because Lewis realized that organizing the unskilled was the only way to defend the whole labor movement. The CIO wound up taking a stance against lynching, segregation, and racial discrimination. This history is absent in Israel. The only labor struggles and political strikes that have challenged settler colonialism have been Palestinian. I want to take one little detour about the Mizrahi question, because I know that comes up a lot. People say, well, what about the Mizrahis, because they are discriminated against? And first, we need to reject arguments that Mizrahi Jews are more backward or hawkish than Ashkenazi Jews, which is another common argument. It's racist. I mean, Israeli-born Jews tend to be more right-wing than their parents who immigrated from Arab or Muslim-majority countries, so I think country of origin or ethnicity probably has little to do with it. It's much more accurate to identify class and education as factors in levels of hawkishness. So while Mizrahi Jews constitute 49.2% of the overall population, they're a majority of the working class, certainly the blue-collar labor, and amongst the poor. A result of early on policies of discrimination and a low level of social mobility within Israeli society. Mizrahis are just as likely to adopt liberal politics if they're wealthy or educated and employed in middle class positions. Liberal Zionism, an Ashkenazi birth child, is an extremely racist ideology based on the romantic notion of a return to the East while rejecting all that is Eastern, except for the food. That includes Eastern Jews. On the one hand, Jews of the Orient were seen as a bridge to the Jewish mythical past, but they themselves were looked down on by their European brethren. A founding Zionist philosopher, Abba Evin, said about Mizrahi Jews that, quote, "Far from regarding our immigrants from Oriental countries as a bridge toward our integration with the Arab-speaking world, our object should be to infuse them with an Occidental spirit rather than to allow them to drag us into an unnatural Orientalism." Leadership was in agreement with him. Ben-Gurion famously stated, quote, "The Moroccan Jew took a lot from the Moroccan Arab, and I don't see much we can learn from the Moroccan Arabs. The culture of Morocco I wouldn't want to have here." Mizrahi's support for Likud, the right wing, which started in the 60s, was a rejection of that racist liberal Zionist establishment, which discriminated against them. It was a rebellion against the Histadrut and Mapai, at the hands of which, writes Michael Shalev, quote, "they were dealt with harshly by means of a residual system of niggardly means tested benefits and manipulative forms of so-called treatment and rehabilitation." These means-based benefits, as opposed to employment-based benefits, were used by Mapai to subjugate blue-collar Mizrahi workers to their political dominion, a la votes and Histadrut membership dues that offered the Mizrahi workers little in return. However, the fact that the lower-income bracket in Israel tends to be more right-wing is a testament to the bitterness of their battle over the resources of Palestine. Upper and middle-class white Jews whose parents own land and who have well-paid jobs in high-tech have enjoyed greater benefits from the occupation. Lower-income Mizrahis who live on the front line of Gaza may sound more brutish when speaking of Palestinians, but Ashkenazi Jews and kibbutzniks can sound just as brutish during war and defend their land or homes and livelihood with equal fervor. Moreover, we shouldn't underestimate the importance of Jews of any ethnicity to the Israeli state. Unlike Palestinians, who are under constant threat of ethnic cleansing, Mizrahis are Jews, and as such, they are inexpendable. And because they are inexpendable, we shouldn't underestimate the commitment of the majority Mizrahi working class to Israel. And so, but why, despite the discrimination, the lack of social mobility, and the economic degradation that the neoliberal has brought on the entire class, does the working class remain committed as ever to the Zionist project, and in fact, like I said, pulls further to the right? So the Israeli welfare structure that we discussed earlier as offering high living standards worked till the 70s in conjunction with state subsidies of capital, and these subsidies created a cocoon for business in its early years. Until the late 1950s, this system worked effectively. The economy consistently grew, aided by the massive influx of immigrants. In the 60s, however, immigration and foreign investment both dropped, resulting in diminished economic growth. So, hoping to weaken labor militancy, which had been on the rise due to conditions of full employment, and in order to rid itself of non-profitable and less competitive capital, the labor government initiated a major recession in 1966. This caused a wave of bankruptcies and mergers, wiping out many of the smaller firms and hastening a process of consolidation of private capital. But it didn't spur growth. Instead, the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza significantly increased Israel's domestic market while providing a cheap and highly exploitable source of labor, Palestinians. And by the end of the mid-80s, they made up 7% of the Israeli labor force. Introducing this pool of marginal labor tempered Jewish labor. It offered a new section of blue-collar workers opportunities to advance. David Hall Kathala, who studied the Israeli peace movement between 67 and 87, writes, quote, "To begin with, the occupation of the territories opened up new markets and provided a vast, cheap labor reserve. This led to an economic independence and upward mobility for many Mizrahim, which had interesting results. Firstly, they came to favor the occupation not because they desired to settle the territories, but because the influx of cheap Arab labor meant that many of them no longer had to do the work of Arab riffraff." Israel's new territorial expansion also came with advantageous terms for trade in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Sinai Peninsula. The state was able to import cheap oil and other resources and export merchandise to a totally captive market. And the failure to convert back from military to civilian production was a result of the growing power of capitalist interests and the global neoliberal order, which made welfare systems unsustainable. In 1985, the Israeli labor-led government passed the Economic Stabilization Plan and signed a free trade agreement with the U.S. Now, since 2001, Israel has experienced basically exclusively center-right and far-right governments, so many attribute the collapse of welfare to the rise of the right, but it was labor that introduced neoliberalism to Israel. Under the U.S. influence, the stabilization plan hailed the beginning of an era of free market policies, wage freezes, introduction of foreign workers, reductions of government spending on infrastructure and education, the annulment of many public housing tenants' rights, mostly Mizrahi population. The privatization of health services, though it remains universal, and welfare services, though the department is still a governmental one. Haaretz reported that in 2011, one in three families required welfare help, an increase of about 75% from the year 1998. A large majority of applicants needed help with aging parents or disability and medical issues. Only 16% applied due to poverty. Even though gaps in Israeli society today are the second, largest in the Western world after the U.S., I think one way to understand it is that the government spends 35% more on Jewish residents, even though Palestinians are three times as likely to be poor. So a large population that is calculated into those wage gaps is effectively cut off from aid. And despite an erosion of social benefits and pension, benefits such as social security, benefits such as social security exist for everyone paying into a system to which employers and the government contribute as well. The system also offers disability payments, home assistance for disabled people, for parents with disabled children, or for the elderly. The safety net also includes short-term sickness grants, maternity grants and benefits, government pensions for anyone who's paid into the system for at least 12 years. That sounds good, right? And though most poverty is a result of rising housing costs, there are about 2,000 homeless people out of a population of a little over 8 million, so 0.02%. So New York City, just to compare, is 8.5 million people, and there's 58,000 homeless people. It's slightly higher than the overall rate in the U.S., but it just gives you a sense. Also, Israel, unlike other Arab countries in the region, received non-qualified loans and aid from the U.S. This allowed the Israeli economy to develop rapidly. Through the 90s, Adam Haniyeh writes in his book Lineages of Revolt, direct U.S. financial support helped to enable the development of high value-added export industries connected to sectors such as information technology, pharmaceuticals, and security. Again, unlike with other countries, the U.S. allowed Israel massive trade deficits, and the American push for the normalization of Israel in the 90s through the Oslo agreements let Israel's economy experience a leap in growth. Furthermore, the U.S. arms economy fed directly into the Israeli arms industry, which turned Israel into a leading international security and armor exporter. Shalev writes that ultimately the maintenance of the occupation, quote, reflected the vested interests of the occupation's economic beneficiaries, producers and employers, as well as workers in Israel. The growth of American aid was both implicitly and explicitly directed towards Israel's military aggrandizement. This had the effect of increasing the emphasis on arms production and of diminishing the overall economic reach of the state. No longer is foreign aid an imperialist incentive directly invested in the working class's livelihood. Israeli workers were now rewarded through the arms economy. The working class has become dependent on the education, housing, and career opportunities their participation in the Israeli Defense Forces affords them. They've found routes for advancement in the military-fueled high-tech industry. And as pensions and real wages were eroded, the cheaper cost of living in the occupied territories have become essential. Finally, like a community surrounding a prison, the upkeep of life in the 67 territories requires all sorts of services beyond the scope of the military that provide Israelis with livelihood. So by shifting investment to revolve primarily around war, occupation, and arms production, the working class is now more directly dependent on the war economy. So long as Israel continues to expand and evict Palestinians from lands repurposed for Jews and to retain the wealth stolen in 1948, the Israeli working class continues to be a colonizing force and an enforcer of occupation. Even its most oppressed sections demand not democratic rights and equal distribution to all, but rather their own fair share of Zionist plunder. Insofar as this wealth is declining for the class overall, in an era of neoliberalism and through the deterioration of the welfare state, the Israeli working class aspires to return the wealth to itself. The lower the rung in society, the more bitter the battle for the booty. Bitter the battle for the booty. Well, that's not going in the article. Much like prison guards and the communities whose livelihood depends on the prison, prisoners will not likely find allies in them, prison guards. Their interests are in conflict. The denial of one's freedom is the precondition of the other's livelihood. And this brings me to my final point. The nation that oppresses another nation forges its own chains, wrote Karl Marx. The socialist understanding is that the working class of an oppressor nation can't be liberated while oppressing another. True. But what if it also can't exist otherwise? What freedoms, rights, or benefits would it give up to protect its own existence? Marxists support nationalist movements for self-determination insofar as they deal a blow to imperialism and oppression. We support it if it advances the interests of the working class, and when the success of that struggle means the elimination of the common enemy, the oppressor nation, bringing to the fore the natural antagonism of the working class with its own national ruling class. The realization of the Zionist project didn't bring about the end of the existence of some common oppressing enemy for the Jewish working class and their bourgeoisie. In fact, it entrenched one and created the Arab and Palestinian enemy. Also, a movement for self-determination isn't supported by socialists when, like in Israel, it relies on the continued dispossession and suppression of the will and rights of indigenous people. Palestinians are denied entrance to Israel, can't return to their homes and lands, denied citizenship, equal rights, and voting rights, basic democratic and civil liberties. Zionism hasn't advanced the international working class movement. On the contrary, it's blunted class struggle within Israel, it's aided and abetted imperialist nations and ruthless dictatorships across the world, and it's committed countless atrocities in the name of sovereignty, of its sovereignty, against the Palestinian people and the Palestinian peasant and working class. Palestinian nationalism advances democracy in the region by opposing a regime that supports dictatorships and imperialist policies around the world. So democratic movements against Israel play a role in advancing the international working class's liberation. You know, it's hard to envision a socialist revolution that wouldn't stem from an international anti-imperialist and democratic movement. Because their rights to full citizenship, the right of return, and an end to Israeli military occupation of the land, sea, and air in Palestine would negate the existence of Israel as a Jewish ethnocracy, the Israeli working class's existence as a Jewish working class per se is undermined by a democratic revolution. The numerous benefits and the wealth that undergirds its standard of living would need to be withdrawn in a democratic solution. In the West Bank and Gaza, per capita GDP is around $4,300. In Israel, it is roughly $35,000. So desegregating the Israeli and Palestinian economies would expose the Israeli working class to a potential free fall in living standards. And Israeli workers, unsurprisingly, have failed, in fact, to draw real democratic conclusions from social movements, with one notable exception in the early 70s when the Mizrahi Israeli Black Panthers connected their oppression to the racism and discrimination Palestinians were faced with. This was a remarkable occurrence and was likely influenced by the Matzpen activists who supported them. Ultimately, they too subordinated the question of Zionism to the economic issues they faced, although I think it's telling that that movement was more brutally and violently suppressed than any other social justice movement in Israeli history. The 2011 tent movement, which was openly inspired by the democratic and social movement of the Arab Spring, was led mainly by middle-class Ashkenazi Jews who had in the past been beneficiaries of the welfare state. Neoliberalism and privatization had benefited many of the young protesters' parents, which would explain why their demands aspired to regain lost privileges and not to do away with neoliberalism and the free market, much less the settler colonial nature of Israel. And despite the call for social justice, any calls for democratic change in Israel were unequivocally rejected by the vast majority of the movement. A socialist revolution can't depend on an apolitical class struggle. It's got to be regional, it's democratic, it's got to include Palestinians. So I've said the following. Look at that, I'm wrapping up. I said that a settler colonial working class relates to the state in a fundamentally different way than a regular working class. It's given many incentives to promote colonization and acts as a collaborator with its own ruling class. Second, I've shown how the formation of the Israeli working class necessarily came at the expense of the formation of a multiracial working class. Third, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine as a form of primitive accumulation and decades of directly benefiting from foreign aid have allowed the Israeli working class to acquire wealth and a standard of living it's unwilling to give up. Insofar as this wealth is declining in the era of neoliberalism and the deterioration of the welfare state, the working class wishes to return to an era in which it had a greater portion of the wealth offered by the colonization of Palestine. And fourth, I've concluded that the shift from the welfare state to a warfare economy has deepened the Israeli working class's reliance on the occupation as a prison guard tied to the prison for his or her livelihood. Finally, I've contended that the self-determination and rights of Palestinians or any indigenous population necessarily negate those of the colonizing working class. This is demonstrated most clearly, I think, by Israeli opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The call for equal citizenship rights and the right of return, which are the central demands of the boycott movement, have been rejected by the Zionist left as well as the working class. However, the fact that the boycott may alienate Israelis is not a strong argument against it, precisely because of what I argued here. On the contrary, I think the struggle for a democratic Middle East, which the BDS movement is a crucial part of, has the most potential to change the character of the Israeli working class from a counter-revolutionary force to a potentially revolutionary one. I mean, it should be obvious that Israeli workers aren't incapable of solidarizing with Palestinians from a human perspective, but because of their material conditions. Were those to be changed by a revolutionary movement, democratic or socialist, the Israeli working class could potentially be won to an internationalist perspective, which is fundamental to socialism. So, in our struggle for Palestinian liberation, we have to look to the revolutionary potential of the Arab masses, a glimpse of which I think we've seen in the Arab Spring. And that's it.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.